We become known as someone who gets out and flies in support of science. We fly in support of civil issues.
Alaska is selected as one of six FAA drone test sites. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, December 30th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, understanding the Pentagon's strategy for the Arctic.
When you look at the members of the Arctic Council and those that may want to join the Arctic Council, I think that's our center of gravity.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaskans who experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, and mental health conditions are important members of the state's workforce. From healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants, Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages Alaska employers to consider ways in which trust beneficiaries and their unique skills can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
A University of Alaska-led consortium has been selected by the Federal Aviation Administration to operate an unmanned aerial vehicle test center. It will be one of six centers across the country charged with helping integrate the technology into national airspace. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, Alaska partnered with Oregon and Hawaii on the successful proposal.
The Alaska Center for Unmanned Aircraft Systems Integration was formed with $5 million from the state legislature in 2012 to pursue the technology and FAA test center status. Center Deputy Director Ro Bailey says Alaska augmented its immense open space for testing in the proposal by teaming with Hawaii and Oregon to meet additional FAA requirements.
They also wanted the ability to do high-altitude, high-speed flying, but not over land. Well, having Hawaii in our partnership meant that we could offer that kind of capability very easily. In addition, of course, Hawaii gives us tropical, Oregon gives us high desert and even low desert. And so what we end up being able to do is satisfy more of the FAA requirements.
The FAA test center status does not come with any federal money, but Bailey says there's major economic potential.
By virtue of the industry and users who want to come and test their systems and get them approved by the FAA.
Bailey says the test center will likely result in UAV businesses setting up shop in Alaska. A McDowell Group analysis estimates that a test center will result in over 1,400 new jobs by 2017 when the centers are scheduled to complete their mission. Bailey credits Alaska's success in securing federal test center status to the work of University of Alaska Fairbanks Poker Flat Research Range Manager Greg Walker, who shepherded numerous UAV projects in and outside Alaska for more than a decade. Work, she says, has built a strong reputation.
We've become known as someone who can integrate a variety of different sensors depending on our clients' needs. We've become known as someone who gets out and flies in support of science. We fly in support of civil issues.
A UAF-operated drone was used to help plot a route across sea ice to Nome during an emergency midwinter fuel delivery in 2012. The new UA Center will provide more than testing of UAVs for industry, science, and public safety. The center's Bailey says it'll also play a role in regulatory development.
Processes and procedures that could ultimately become the permanent rule for anyone who wants to fly unmanned aircraft in the United States.
A lot of flying robots whizzing over Alaska will likely raise privacy issues in a state where people take their freedom seriously. Senator Mark Begich considers it another attribute to conducting testing here.
And I always tell these guys, if you want to test privacy issues, what's acceptable and what's not, there's no better place than Alaska.
The University of Alaska-led FAA Center will be joined by five other UAV testing programs in Nevada, New York, North Dakota, Texas, and Virginia. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Last month, the Department of Defense released an 8-point Arctic strategy. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel presented the document at the Halifax International Security Forum in Nova Scotia. It is a military blueprint for managing the future of international shipping, territorial sovereignty, tourism, and security in a rapidly changing Arctic. In the first of a two-part interview, Alaska's top military official, Lieutenant General Russell Handy, says what stands out from the plan is how much is yet unknown.
I think perhaps the biggest challenge is going to be to look into our crystal ball on what our requirements will be. You know, there's not total agreement, for example, on the ice melt and the rate at which that's occurring or the impact that's going to have on increased economic development up in the Arctic. I mean, we're responsible to maintain an awareness of that domain and try to ensure via partnership with the international community freedom of navigation in international waterways in accordance with international norms. But how much of that is there going to be? And then how much infrastructure do you have to put there? If there's going to be a lot of tourism, for example, in the Arctic, well, we and the state and local officials need to be ready for that. If there's some sort of a search and rescue requirement that either we over land in the Alaskan Command or Admiral Ostebo in U.S. Coast Guard District 17 needs to conduct over the water, we need to have thought through that in advance. And so that's probably the most challenging, is envisioning what will the Arctic look like in 20 or 25 years.
Are there elements of the Arctic strategy that will be implemented immediately?
There are. In fact, there's elements of that strategy ongoing right now, which is why it was so exciting for us to be able to offer input, because we were able to say, boy, that's a really good idea. And in fact, let me show you what we're already doing. And so our team has been conducting many things that you sort of read between the lines in that Arctic strategy for some time. We have a series of working groups where we bring together public and private partners and talk about activities that are ongoing. That was sort of, you know, as with any analysis, self-awareness is the first step. And so we brought everyone together and we're talking about what each other are doing. And we're learning quite a bit about what's going on up at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, for example, nationally, internationally recognized as a center of excellence for Arctic studies. What's going on in the corporate world up on the Northern Slope. And we're actually learning many things that we can capitalize on from a Defense Department perspective from the people that have been doing this for a number of years. And in fact, my predecessor signed a memorandum of agreement with President Gamble from the University of Alaska that outlined areas where we will partner. And we have an active partnership going with UAF in everything from Arctic awareness, maritime domain awareness, to how might you employ remotely piloted vehicles for command and control purposes. And so we're actively partnering with them and others.
As you're probably aware, there's a lot of controversy about unmanned aerial vehicles. Do you see that as something that could be used for simple reconnaissance in the Arctic, or how do you envision that might be a way to enhance surveillance in that area?
I think there's tremendous growth opportunity for remotely piloted vehicles, but I do think we have to very carefully look at what we're doing with them, how we're doing it, and in some cases, who is doing it. And what I mean by that is there's a big difference between a private corporation who is looking at their facilities with a remotely piloted vehicle, or the UAF doing research, or frankly, even the United States Coast Guard, who has law enforcement authority using it. Big difference between that and the Department of Defense, a Title 10 activity. And as you know, we have legislation that protects our citizens from the military doing things that look like civilian law enforcement. So we have to be very careful that we're doing it for the right reasons. That said, we will partner with all of our both public and private partners that we're working with right now to ensure that we help each other, because the DOD has tremendous capacity in remotely piloted vehicles. We've got a lot of experience with them. And so we can either work together on programs or as a very minimum, pass on our expertise to those that will use them.
Secretary Hagel said that the Department of Defense must evolve its Arctic infrastructure and capabilities at a pace consistent with changing conditions. That would seem to suggest a nearly immediate start based on how quickly the Arctic is changing and the complete lack of Arctic infrastructure today. What do you anticipate, or when do you anticipate, actual building of facilities may happen, and where? Will it be Kotzebue, Barrow, Nome? What's known about that?
Secretary Hagel did say that, but also in the document he outlined the cautionary note, and that is, let's be careful that we very carefully analyze where we need an infrastructure investment, so that when we take taxpayer dollars, we're investing it in something that we really need, when lined up against all of the other things that the DOD has to invest in for the defense of our national interest. And so I think I read in that he's going to be very careful in large-scale investment. That said, we can get a lot done with a very small investment by partnering with, as I said, the UAF, other private organizations and public organizations, our international partners. I think that's a key area for growth as well. When you look at the members of the Arctic Council and those that may want to join the Arctic Council, I think that's our center of gravity. You continue to evolve capabilities together, because no one of us can do that alone. And so to do that, we all need to come to a common understanding of what international norms are. And so talking often in forums like the Arctic Council, I think, is important. And then working together to build those capabilities, because I wouldn't say there's a total lack of infrastructure and equipment. I would say there's a lot of opportunity there. But if you look at everything that's in place in the public and private world and with our international partners, I think it might surprise you as to what capability does exist or could exist for a reasonable investment in the near term to, I believe, satisfy the Defense Department's strategy. In the far term, again, the trick is going to be understanding what the Arctic will look like in 2030. As you know, the DoD doesn't build anything quickly. And so if we're going to field programs, we have to look in advance and build a program to be able to fund that and march carefully. And so understanding where those capabilities need to be in, say, 2025 or 2030, I think will be the cornerstone to any investment strategy.
Lieutenant General Russell Handy is the senior military officer for Alaska. Tomorrow evening, we'll hear more about military investment, training, and the importance of the Arctic Council. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, creative ways to save native language.
Put Tlingit on the ferry so that when you get on the ferry and you're pulling into Huna, you can hear Tlingit telling you about this place, Huna.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com.
And by
Rural Energy Enterprises, supplying Alaska dealers with fuel-efficient Toyo stoves and Oil Miser heaters for more than 26 years. Local dealers can be found at rural-energy.com.
M. Marcel Jackson, one of Alaska's first female doctors, has died at age 84. Jackson's medical career dated from territorial days. During early statehood, Jackson was one of a handful of women doctors practicing in the state. She died on December 8th in Anchorage. Jackson was born in Lewistown, Montana in 1929. She earned a bachelor's degree in biology from Montana State University, moving to Alaska in 1951. She became a lab technician for Anchorage doctors, one of whom urged her to pursue a medical degree. A service is scheduled for January 19th in Anchorage. The Paxson Lodge is closed. The owner of the roadhouse at the junction of the Richardson and Denali highways says he shut the lodge down due to slow business and high operating costs. As KYC's Tim Ellis reports, it's the latest of several Richardson Highway roadhouses that have closed down in recent years.
Since the 1950s, the Paxson Lodge has offered travelers a place to stretch their legs and fill up with gas and coffee. The lodge served as a friendly outpost on the long drive over the Richardson Highway between Delta Junction and Glen Allen. But no more. Owner Chet Eldridge says he's not getting anywhere near enough business to pay the $2,000 a week that it costs to heat the place and keep the generator running. So he closed it to hold down costs while he talks with a realtor about selling it.
And it just got to the point where we couldn't afford to run it this winter. With the price of fuel like it is.
The diesel he had trucked in from North Pole fueled furnaces and a generator that provides electricity for the lodge, located about 30 miles from the nearest power line. Eldridge says he used to make money selling power to a few other area businesses under an arrangement set up by the previous owners, Stan and Wanda Brown. He bought the business from the Browns in 1997. 10 years later, after he and his wife suffered some health problems, they decided it was time to get out of the business. They sold the lodge in 2007, but the buyer failed to keep up with payments and upkeep, and Eldridge repossessed the lodge in April. Since then, he and his family have worked hard to get the lodge back in business without its power sales customers, who quit buying electricity because of problems with the generators that he says were not properly maintained.
Every dime we brought in, we put back in it, trying to get it to go on.
But the Paxson Lodge just doesn't bring in much money. Like most of Alaska's tourism-dependent businesses, the lodges struggle to get by. Eldridge thinks the business at the lodge isn't likely to improve much anytime soon because big operators like Princess Cruises and Holland America Line aren't bringing in busloads of tourists anymore. He says instead they pretty much only stop at their own hotels elsewhere along the route. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
The Bureau of Land Management is planning to do a quick field season at the Red Devil Mine to try to stop the large tailings piles from eroding into Red Devil Creek. But there are more than 250,000 cubic yards of contaminated ground at the site. KYUK's Ben Matheson reports.
Red Devil Creek runs right past the abandoned mine site, where leached metals like mercury, arsenic, and antimony enter the water system and make their way towards the Kuskokwim. Earlier projects have plugged old mining shafts and removed barrels of chemicals, but the biggest legacy of 40 years of mining is the rocks and dirt. Those continue to leach into the watershed, according to Mike McCrum, the Red Devil project manager.
We're looking at the groundwater, we're looking at sediments in the creek, and then we're looking at the large piles of tailings that are on site that were left by the mining operation. And we're looking at those three different media in different ways because they each present their own set of problems.
Four site-wide cleanup alternatives under consideration address each of those areas of concern. The first option is to take no action. The second option puts an 8-foot-high fence all around the site to keep people and wildlife out. The third option actually addresses the tailings and moves them to higher ground in an on-site repository,
which is sort of like a landfill. You know, we would prepare the ground, we would put them all in one place, we would cover them with some kind of material that would help prevent snowmelt and rainfall from infiltrating into the pile and leaching metals, and then we would probably monitor that, you know, over a period of time to make sure that the cover is doing what needs to be done.
The fourth and most extensive option involves digging up the tailings and shipping them all to the lower 48 for disposal in a special facility. The BLM hopes to have the feasibility study done by next summer. It's currently making the rounds in a multi-agency, in-depth analysis.
You know, these are documents that BLM is developing with its contractor, but then it's extensively reviewed by the EPA, by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, by the Alaska Department.
And so on. The BLM would next turn the studies into a proposed plan and bring that for public input before the final record of decision and work could go ahead. That could still be a number of years. I'm Ben Matheson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Since 1978, the Older Persons Action Group has been the publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families. They now offer a digital version online at SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Indigenous languages throughout North America are teetering on extinction. In southeast Alaska, less than 200 people can speak Tlingit, Haida, or Tsimshian. But a Tlingit language expert suggests Indigenous language loss can be prevented by addressing it at three levels. From Juneau, KTLO's Lisa Fu has more.
Lance Twitchell says it's time for a dramatic shift in the way Alaskans look at endangered languages like Tlingit. Twitchell is an assistant professor of Native languages at the University of Alaska Southeast.
Sometimes we say, you know, the language is dying, we don't have many speakers, and some of these things get so insurmountable in your mind that you don't really know where to start.
The first place to start, Twitchell says, is at the individual level. He says it's important to speak as much as you can on a daily basis.
I tell students, I was like, find something that's the only thing you speak Tlingit to. dog, cat, steering wheel, shower head, mirror, and make that switch.
Since the 1800s, Alaska Natives have experienced discrimination, forced assimilation, and boarding schools that prohibited children from speaking their language. Twitchell says due to post-traumatic stress disorder and intergenerational trauma, many students of Tlingit have a fear of failing or being chastised.
Our grandparents experienced great violence for our language. Our parents experienced great neglect with their language. We are trying to look at all those things so that our children and our grandchildren will just speak.
Learning the language is an act of healing, Twitchell says. At an individual level, it's not about changing the world, but by trying to speak a Tlingit word every day. The next step is making a dramatic shift at the community level. One way to do this is by implementing language into place.
When I went to Hawaii, I came off the plane and the first thing I heard was Hawaiian. And I thought, that's what we need to do. We're trying to put Tlingit on the ferry so that when you get on the ferry and you're pulling into Huna, you can hear Tlingit telling you about this place, Huna.
The state also must be involved in the rebuilding of a language, Twitchell says. Part of this involves admission.
We see a trail of responsibility that does go to federal governments, state governments, and religious organizations as far as what has put us in this situation with their languages. So there has to be conscious efforts made to reverse language shift.
Linguist Alice Taff says a language resurgence in Southeast Alaska is part of a worldwide movement against language loss.
Every nation in this planet has small language communities that are standing their ground against language loss. And it's a relatively new phenomenon that there is this pushing back from within the community saying, this is us and we're going to use our own voices.
Of the estimated 20,000 Tlingit people in the world, Twitchell says only 140 can speak the language. He says the dramatic shift that needs to be made at the individual, community, and state levels is not a matter of tolerating Tlingit speaking, but embracing it. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Students at Dillingham's Alternative School had the opportunity to train for an emergency trauma technician certification this month. An ETT can provide basic medical care in emergency situations, and graduates have not only helped save lives, but have also gone on to careers in the medical field. KDLG's Dave Benninger stopped by on their last day of training.
It's 11 a.m. on December 12th, and 17-year-old Kayla Brothers is about to give birth to a child.
Ow! What a good mom. Is it going to be a boy or a girl?
Girl.
Okay, Kayla's not really giving birth on this day, but she did volunteer to pretend that she is so that Kayleen Chuckwuck and David Roll could rehearse emergency obstetrics under the guidance of ETT instructor Ron Bowers, heard here setting the stage.
Okay, so you get called to a house, you're a first responder, you get called to a house, so let's say you're over in Leavelock for Christmas and somebody goes into labor, and you're the first one there, so you're going to ask the lady some questions.
Kayleen runs through those questions with the patient to get an idea of her history and how soon that baby may be expected.
When's your due date?
Wasn't it supposed to be December 10th?
December 10th. Has the vag of water broken?
Yeah.
Oh, and that's something we should let you know, guys. There's a sac around the baby called the amniotic.
Have you had any children before?
We know that babies do not always arrive as planned, and expectant mothers in Bristol Bay are not always able to get to a hospital for the birth. Bowers discusses this with the students after they've moved over to the obstetrical mannequin where the baby's head is beginning to crown.
So her husband's telling you, hey, why don't you just go and let's just get her in the truck and let's go to the airport. Come on, we got to go to the hospital. What are you waiting for? What are you going to tell?
No, she's crowning.
We can't because she's crowning.
Right
the baby
now.
Is coming out.
So what's
very
that
soon, and we won't have time to go bring her to the hospital.
No,
if we go now, that it would. The
baby's coming right now.
The baby will come on the way to the hospital.
As the baby makes its way, David prepares to suction with a bob syringe, and Kayleen is set to receive.
You're going
to
be catching a baby. Remember, don't catch a baby with your gloved hands. It's very slippery, so he's got a little blanket prepared.
Okay,
and his mission is going to be, where's the other blanket? You're going to, once the baby comes out, she's going to give you the baby.
Both hands.
You'd be crying.
Kayleen and David deliver the baby, wrap her in blankets, stimulate the breathing, cut the umbilical cord, and lay her with the mother. Bowers gives them a thumbs up on the exercise. Both say they could do this in real life if they had to.
I think I'd be able to do this.
If it was a real emergency, I believe I could get it done.
The state of Alaska says the ETT program was originally developed to staff first responders in southeast logging camps, where one can imagine some obvious wounds and difficulties in medevacing patients. It's evolved since those days and now requires 40 hours of training. And though it's still just a basic introduction to emergency care, these two students say they feel prepared to respond to the unexpected.
I learned CPR and I learned how to bandage and splint wounds, like really huge gashes. I could stop the bleeding and I could get someone ready to transport.
If you're out somewhere and you're with a bunch of friends and you're the only one who knows this stuff and someone gets in an accident, and we could be pretty far from a village or a town or something, so I'd be there and I'd actually have an idea of what we are supposed to do, and it could help by saving someone's life.
That these students could go from this class and be ready to save a life is not just theoretical, says MAP instructor John Montooth.
We had one that just a couple weeks after the class, his nephew got into some medicine and he knew what to do and was able to talk to the medical people as they were coming out and help his nephew, possibly saved his life. We had another student a week after graduated, found a lady hypothermic on the street and was able to help her out.
There isn't a huge market for certified ETTs, although their skills are certainly sought after for volunteer fire and EMS departments. Most of the paying jobs require at least an EMT certification, but as Bowers points out, ETT provides an entry into the medical field from which many go on to bigger and better things.
It's a chance for them to look at it, and some may say, that's not for me, and just use the skills some time down the road helping somebody, but others will say, yeah, I like it, I'm going to get into that career field. A number have gone on to become health aides. We've seen some become paramedics, get in a nursing program, and over the years, and so I think it's a great program.
The following day, 16 MAP students took their test for ETT certification. 8 of them passed, and 5 more will pass after they complete their CPR training at the end of the month. Aside from the certification, the students also earn 1 credit for high school and 3 for college. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Ben Matheson in Nome, Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Dave Benninger in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority would like to recognize businesses and organizations that employ Alaskans who experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, and mental health conditions. When you hire a mental health trust beneficiary, you're not just providing a job, you're providing an opportunity to showcase unique skills, a strong work ethic, and a desire to succeed. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
Public Education Health Trust, formerly NEA Alaska Health Plan, delivers cost-effective health plans for Alaska families. They help Alaska's educational professionals, from school bus drivers to teachers, manage their health plan benefits efficiently. Public Education Health Trust provides members with low-cost plans, more choices, and local control, advocating for 17,000 Alaskans and their health care needs. This message sponsored by Public Education Health Trust.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.